Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, that worked. And I guess we'll go right into our theme. Welcome to the Jeff Bushman Experience. This is Jeff Bushman. On today's show, we'll talk about Israeli election results and the prospects of coalition. Also, who agrees with me? No, that's not a question. And finally, the perversion and prostitution of Constitution education, and we'll talk about the Bill of Rights, if there's time. But in the meantime, you're here, I'm here, welcome to the program. It is Sunday, the 22nd of March, 2015, when we're doing this show live. It is 31 minutes after the hour, and if you're on the East Coast, or otherwise following Eastern Time, that is the East Coast of the United States, it is 6:31. Again, welcome to the program. We will get into all of those subjects, and I have the Bill of Rights before me. And we hope we'll be able to get that discussed within the half hour, at least part of them. The trivia question for you at the moment, before we go into a word from one of our sponsors, which is, well, never mind that, is who was the principal person who was responsible for writing the Bill of Rights? Okay. I'll give you a hint. He was short, if that's helpful to you. In any event, before we talk about the show, there's two things I want to tell you about. Number one is if you would like to see some of the writing we've done and also have access to our specifically to our books on Amazon, you can start out by going to bushmanbooks.blogspot.com. Bushman spelled like an Aborigine, bushmanbooks.blogspot.com. And from there, you can go visit our books. But you can also just read the stuff that's in there. We didn't do anything on the site this week, but last week we did talk about a number of things. But one of the things we did is we had some trivia questions there for you involving presidents, presidential politics, and American coinage. So if you find that interesting, or you don't, please go ahead and go to that site. Also, if you are in Arizona or you have legal business in Arizona, we might be able to help you, specifically Lighthouse Process Serving, and that would be for the purpose, obviously, of serving summonses or petitions or anything else in the state of Arizona, but not outside. And if you would care to find out more about that, hope you don't need to, but if you do, you go to the website that has most of the original name of the company, which is lighthouseattorney.blogspot.com. Now known as Lighthouse Process Serving, but originally Lighthouse Attorney Service. Again, lighthouseattorney.blogspot.com. Okay, let's talk about our subjects. As almost anyone on the planet knows, Israel had their elections last week, and the party with the greatest number of seats, but not a majority, was Likud, the party of incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I had said last week on the show, and if you weren't here, you should be ashamed of yourself. Last week on the show, we talked about my prediction, which has still not come true and may not conceivably, but my prediction was is what you will end up with is what's called a government of national unity, where the two biggest parties get together. The two biggest parties are the Likud bloc and the Zionist Union, so-called, but it's principally the Labor Party. My suspicion is those two will get together and switch off who gets to be prime minister and who has the various important roles in government. No one's talking about that really now. At first, the president of Israel, which is not the same as our president, he is in a generally ceremonial position, but he gets to ask the leaders of the parties to form governments. And in this case, he's invited Netanyahu to do that because Likud, Netanyahu's party, got the greatest number of votes. So the president of Israel, whose last name is Rivlin, went ahead and asked Netanyahu to form the government. The Arab party, if you look at the numbers of which parties got the greater, got each of the significant numbers of seats, you'll see that after Likud and the Zionist Union, the next party is a group of Arab parties. parties, which I'm guessing is highly unlikely to join Netanyahu's government, particularly after his statement that there will be no Palestinian state on his watch during the campaign. He has since backtracked from that. But if the Arab parties, in fact, are not going to go with Likud, Likud is going to have a very hard time getting enough parties with enough seats to gain a controlling majority of the parliament, what's called there the Knesset. So that's where you are. And so I am, again, reiterating that I think it's going to be the Likud bloc and the Zionist Union sharing power in some fashion in the new government. By the way, that has happened before. Netanyahu was not one of the principals at the time, but about, I want to say 15 years ago, if I recall, there was a so-called government of national unity where just that occurred. Usually those governments, those administrations, if you will, in American terms, don't last very long, and they call for new elections. But that is the general idea. You will see as the news unfolds during the coming weeks, I expect probably during this next week, possibly the one after that, you will see whether I was right or not. Time will tell. I said at the top of the show, who agrees with me? And I also said it's not a question. Who stands in this case for the World Health Organization? Occasionally I have said something using the word who and referring to the former head of the Chinese Communist Party, whose who was H-U. But not this time. This time it's WHO, World Health Organization. And they have come out recently, as in fact this week, talking about an ingredient in the product Roundup. Why do I say they agree with me? Well, last week on the program, we talked about GMO crops, genetically modified organisms, GMO corn, GMO wheat, which have made their way into the American diet. It has been pointed out correctly, this is contrary to my point, but it is correct, that if you test someone who has eaten GMO foods or foods with GMO crops in them, and someone who hasn't, you're going to have a very hard time demonstrating any harm in the person who has had the GMO food that's any different from the person who has not. That's true, but it's also, as we discussed, too short a time frame to find that out, because the things which happen in the body as a result of exposure to Roundup, which is an herbicide, it's a weed killer, that is sprayed on the GMO crops. They are modified so they can withstand the Roundup without dying, while the weeds are not so modified. And so there is a great deal more exposure to Roundup or similar herbicides when you're eating GMO foods. That harm does not show up for a long time because the herbicides, just like Agent Orange, although that's not what they're using, thankfully, the herbicides contain products, contain ingredients which change the cells in the human body. The scientific term is they are mutagenic. They mutate those cells. Well, the problem is most mutagens are also carcinogenic. And the World Health Organization came out today saying that, I believe it's glyphosate, which is a major ingredient in Roundup, is probably, they said, meaning they don't have absolute proof, but is probably carcinogenic. So the issue then becomes all the more profound. Eating GMO foods, if who is right, God, that's a silly name, if who is right, then you are risking cancer for you, your family, your children, etc., by consuming GMO foods. That's your right. You can do it. And frankly, it is kind of hard to eat products that are not either fully or partially GMO foods. I don't have the full answer here, but I will tell you that one of the things that has been tried in some states is a requirement of labeling. So you at least get to choose. Right now, if you buy a product off the supermarket shelf and it contains genetically modified organisms, you're simply speaking, not going to know that. Now, some manufacturers will put on their packaging that it contains no GMO foods. Fine. But for those that do contain them, they're not labeled, and many that don't aren't going to be labeled. So right now you don't know. A couple of years ago, they tried in California a what's called an initiative. For those of you who don't live in states where they have the initiative, that's where you gather a bunch of petitions that are sufficient in number to put on the ballot a proposition. And the proposition was to require labeling of foods that had genetically modified organisms. Well, the chemical and food companies, sometimes they're not the same, but sometimes they are, but the chemical and food companies mounted a massive advertising campaign, most of which was nonsensical BS, but persuaded enough voters to vote against the proposition that it failed. One of the things they said is it's going to add layers of government and bureaucracy. Well, it also would have labeled food so that you and I as consumers would have had a choice if we both lived in California. The other factor is that if they were going to label it for California, it would be very much more expensive to not label it elsewhere, to just label it for California. So the odds are pretty good that most manufacturers would have ended up, if that had passed and their lawsuits had been unsuccessful, that would have been filed had it passed, that they would have labeled all foods that are manufactured and available in supermarkets, whether they were GMO containing or not. So that, because California's population is so large. Similarly, when you have certain pollution controls on cars and so forth in California, it ends up affecting most of the nation. So the news of the week is that the World Health Organization came out saying that Roundup contains at least one ingredient that is probably cancer-causing. So there you are. Okay. Before we go on, I want to invite you to call in if you wish to do that, and assuming you're listening live, and if you're not, you can listen next week on Sunday at 6:30 Eastern Time to 7 o'clock Eastern Time and call in then about whatever we're discussing then. But if you want to call in this week, the phone number is area 347-850-8702, repeating 347-850-8702. Wanted to talk for a minute. Actually, I've never talked for a minute about anything. I want to talk for a little while about what I was referring to in the top of the show as the perversion and prostitution of constitutional education. And if we have time after this, pardon me, we'll also talk about the Bill of Rights. By the way, the answer to the trivia question that we posed at the beginning of the show. Who was, not World Health Organization, but what person was responsible for the writing of the Bill of Rights? That is, and for those who are not sure or in another country and don't know our history, the Bill of Rights consists of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And although we will talk both today and in ensuing weeks about what's in the Bill of Rights, those are the amendments that guarantee certain rights to individuals or states, such as freedom of speech, freedom of religion. They should have specified freedom from religion, in my opinion, but freedom of religion, the right to bear arms, the right to reasonable bail and to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, the right to attorney, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, that's what the Bill of Rights is. Who wrote it? James Madison, who ended up being the fourth president of the United States. Clearly, when he wrote the Bill of Rights, he was not the president, or for that matter, he didn't hold a position in government, because when they wrote the Constitution, there was no United States government. So that occurred afterwards. The reason that Madison was asked to write the Bill of Rights, or why the Bill of Rights needed to be done, is because a lot of states, which up to the time of the Constitution actually operated independently from one another, and under what was called the Articles of Confederation that followed the Revolution and preceded the Constitution. But they feared that if you formed a U.S. central government, what we now call the federal government typically, that the states and individuals within the states would lose certain rights that they might otherwise have. So the Bill of Rights had to be written to guarantee those rights to individuals and states, depending on which amendment you're talking about. So the Bill of Rights had to be written in order for the Constitution to get enough states voting in its favor to ratify it. the Constitution required by its terms that three-quarters of the states ratify the document. Ultimately, all 13 of the then existing states did, but for the ratification, they needed 9. So the Bill of Rights is what really put over the Constitution with the states. Anyway, what's happening in so-called education regarding the Constitution is this. What happens is there has been a movement among very conservative individuals and organizations to supposedly offer free education on the Constitution of the United States. And they are worming their way into school systems and schools throughout the country where they can go in and give their version of what the Constitution means. They offer this course as if it were neutral and objective, and it is anything but. Among the things they try and push is that the founding fathers, there were effectively no founding mothers, they were excluded, but that the founding fathers were strong Christians, and that this is a Christian nation. Sometimes they do that, sometimes they don't. But about how elemental Christianity was in the formation of this country. And in fact, it's almost opposite that. The people who, by that I don't mean that the people who founded this country were Muslims. I'm saying instead they were largely what were called deists. A deist is someone who does believe in God, but not in an active, ever-present God. They believe that the universe, the earth, and so forth were created by a God, but that he then figured, okay, you guys are on your own, and basically was not present in everyday life and was not an entity that they prayed to. They did not believe in the Christian version of God. But these people go in and they say that the founding fathers did, it's a Christian nation. There is no place in the Constitution. You can read that sucker backwards, forwards, upside down, and right side up. You will not find anything in there that talks about Christianity. The only thing you'll get is that the word creator, as in they are endowed, I believe this is in the preamble, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Actually, they said unalienable. Unalienable rights. And a creator is capital. The first letter of creator is capitalized. Okay, maybe. But again, that goes back to the deist view of a deity, therefore capital C, but creator, not presence in everyday life. There is a group out there now that has said, I think it's something like the American Family Foundation, and if I'm wrong, I apologize. Not like they listen to this show, but something like the American Family Foundation that says that if you want to come into this country and you're not Christian, you should be required to convert to Christianity because it's a Christian nation. Give me a break. In any event, that's part of, but not all of, the perversion of the Constitution that's going on where these groups want to come in and teach the Constitution. So if you hear in your community that someone wants to come in and teach the kidlets about the Constitution of the United States, find out their agenda and make sure if you disagree with their agenda that you appear at your school board to go ahead and object to their getting in there, because they will do whatever they can to pollute the understanding on the part of the children with regard to what the Constitution really says. Just all kinds of things come up with regard to the Constitution in terms of equal protection under the law and so forth, in terms of the importance of the Constitution. And I'm being vague on purpose because what they do is broad and to some extent vague. Okay, before we go into one of the things we're going to do is we're going to cover a discussion briefly of what the amendments are, say, and what they mean. Some of these 10 amendments, by the way, are kind of dead letters. They don't really have any active utilization. You'll never hear about them, except that it's part of the Bill of Rights, one of the first 10. And though I'm certainly not a lawyer, we can discuss, and I will go ahead and give you my version and understanding of what each of those amendments that we're going to talk about mean. We're not going to discuss all 10 today. We'll cover some of them in ensuing weeks. But before we talk about those amendments, I want to tell you, if you have an opportunity to look it up on the Internet after the show. Please wait until you're finished listening. But if you get a chance to look it up on the internet, there was apparently a British Airlines airplane that was turned back to its airport of origin, which was Heathrow in London. Or Heathrow in England. I guess Heathrow is not actually in London. But the plane was turned back because, I'm trying to be delicate with this, a passenger had used the facilities, and for some reason, the aroma was so pungent. Did I mention you shouldn't be eating lunch right now? Okay, or dinner? Okay. The aroma was so pungent that it was kind of suffocating to all the passengers, and they ended up turning back the plane. And with some of my Facebook friends, I had mentioned that this sounds like a flying Greyhound bus. Not to insult Greyhound or the dogs, but the fact is, I was going to say, when you're on a Greyhound bus, if you're sitting in the wrong place, you'll believe that there was a Greyhound on the bus who couldn't control himself. But, oh, that's terrible. But anyway, yes, if you ever ride on a Greyhound, and I've done more than my share, don't sit near the back of the bus. The two reasons for that is that you have the bathroom back there, and not the world's best ventilation system, to be blunt, and you also have the mother of 17 children. She's always riding in the back of the bus, and usually on the one that I've ridden on. She's back there shouting at the kids, and this only happens, by the way, at night when you're trying to sleep. So if you can avoid Greyhound, of course, you know, there are more convenient or less obnoxious forms of transportation, but if you can't, then don't ride in the back of the bus. It's all I'm suggesting, which, by the way, may explain why it was the segregationists in the 50s wanted African Americans to ride toward the back of the bus so they wouldn't have to. It was another form not only of discrimination but actual punishment. Okay, so that's the story of the BA plane. Getting back to Greyhound, one of my friends said that riding on a Greyhound bus is like seeing the who's who of psychology today, which I thought was unfair to the who's who of psychology today. Okay, let's talk about the Constitution. The Constitution went into effect in 1789. It only passed by reason of, most constitutional scholars believe that it only passed because it had the Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, written by James Madison. Okay, the First Amendment, everybody knows about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment. Almost nobody knows about the Third Amendment. Most people know about the Fifth, aren't too secure in their knowledge of the Sixth and the Seventh, may have a good idea about the Eighth. The Ninth and the Tenth, nobody has any real idea of, and we'll talk about those as part of our discussion of the amendments. But I think this is fairly interesting, and obviously you're welcome to disagree, but I think this is fairly interesting because most people don't really have a good feeling, a strong feeling about the information contained or what's contained in the Bill of Rights. So let's get to it. By the way, we have about 6.5 minutes left at the end of the show, or toward the end of the show. We're going to play a recording we played a few weeks ago. We're going to play it again as a treat, which was the clip of Gary Owens doing the pre-Christmas commercial for Preparation Age. Okay, we'll get to that. The First Amendment, I'm going to read it. By the way, all of these amendments are pretty short, which I can relate to. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Okay. That is enormous. That's three lines, probably two if you print it in smaller type, but it's three lines and is extraordinarily significant and full of interesting and vital rights. Okay? First off, let me talk about the Congress shall make no law. Originally, the most people don't know this. Originally, the Ten Amendments, which guaranteed certain rights to individuals in states, as we talked about before, only applied as restrictions on the federal government. okay? If the state wanted to restrict your right to practice your religion, they could do that. Now, none of the states that I know of did that during the period of the Articles of Confederation. Well, strike that. During the period of the Constitution prior to this becoming applicable to the states, okay? Initially, in 1789 and for some time thereafter, the Bill of Rights was only applicable as it related to restrictions on the federal government, not state governments. So, in theory, the state of Maryland, which was formed by Catholics, could have restricted churches that such that the only churches that could exist would be Catholic churches. They didn't do that, at least not so far as I know. But if they had done that when the Constitution first went into effect, including the Bill of Rights, they could have, because it only related to the federal government. The thing which caused the Bill of Rights to be applicable to the state governments was the Supreme Court's series of decisions, which are called the selective incorporation cases. I have to think for a minute to remember that. The selective incorporation decisions, which said that the 14th Amendment, which I won't read, but which basically gave the rights of all citizens of the various states, gave them all the rights of the federal, of the nation at large. That is, the rights enjoyed by the citizens of each of the states shall also be enjoyed by citizens of the United States and vice versa. It didn't use that exact language, obviously. And during the period of time following the Civil War, following the adoption of the 14th Amendment, over a period of years, going into the early 1900s, the various amendments became applicable to the states, but not all at once. They were done by virtue of various cases that were brought before the court. As you can tell, a discussion of these 10 amendments could take a very long time. But it's important that we all realize what these amendments mean. And by the way, it turns out that shall make no law doesn't really mean that. Okay? What it really has come to mean, when it says, for example, Congress shall make no law, and I'll skip some stuff, says prohibiting the free exercise, well, that's the free exercise of religion, or abridging the freedom of speech. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. To abridge something means to limit it. Okay? So when it says Congress, or again by reason of the incorporation of that right to the state government, shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, it doesn't mean that. Because it can, under certain governments, federal and state, can make certain laws that do in fact limit the right to free speech. The most common cliche, which was once uttered by a Supreme Court justice and then it became part of our everyday speech, is that you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, presumably unless it's on fire. You can't shout fire in a crowded theater, and the reason you can't and the reason why governments can restrict something like that is because it would cause panic and danger, and it's not a matter of free speech in terms of political rights. And free speech generally goes to political speech. Okay? So that's that. Now, we are about out of time. We have about 90 seconds left. I'm going to play this 44-second recording from Gary Owens, if it'll work, and then I'll come back at you. This is Gary Owens, right before Christmas, Preparation H, and here it is.
Christmas means many things to many people. To some, Christmas means glittering lights, gaily wrapped gifts. That's right, sounds of laughter and good cheer. To the folks at Preparation H, it means a time to pause for a few moments to to give thanks to their friends who've been so generous. So from Preparation H to you and yours, a very Merry Christmas.
And you know we're going to play that again a couple of times between now and Christmas. It is now March. So tell your friends to listen in so they can hear on the occasional show the Gary Owens tape. We've got 30 seconds left. We'll cover the rest of the First Amendment and maybe a couple of others next week. Please join us. In the meantime, please be kind to each other. Though you are leaving, please, please, please don't go away mad. Here's our theme.
Mm-hmm.